cooking with a two-slot toaster, if you can call it that. This is a cookbook written by Patrick R.F. Blakely that explores some very creative recipes utilizing a two-slot toaster. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll be required to pass a three-part certification course on the use of your two-slot electric pop-up toaster in conjunction with a general understanding of your home's HVACR system, and you may even cook breakfast. Using this cookbook as a guide, you can learn to prepare dishes such as toast, burnt toast, buttered toast, and buttered toast with jelly. You can also learn to prepare some more unique dishes exclusive to this cookbook, such as hot air, room temperature air, and regular bread. What more could you want? Well, there's probably some more, so crack open this handy companion and do leave home without it, so you don't accidentally lose it. This cookbook is worth at least twice what you're willing to pay. Bone apple tea. Note, anyone who is overwhelmingly lazy can just get toast delivered online instead at a2slottoaster.com. Read the cookbook people are calling accurate. Not weird at all. Thought-provokingly ordinary. Assorted titillating poppycock. Jocular on every page. The best 17th century historical crime thriller of 2023. Wait a second, which book is this again? In the Long Run, Everything is a Toaster, Bruce C. N. Greenwald. This cookbook is dedicated to everyone in the entire world, past and present, except Chef Jim Drake. Cooking with a Two-Slot Toaster, if you can call it that. A cookbook by Patrick R.F. Blakely. First printing January 2023. Copyright 2023 by Patrick R.F. Blakely. All rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced, scanned, or distributed in any printed or electronic form without permission. Please do not participate in or encourage piracy of copyrighted books in violation of the author's rights. Purchase only authorized editions. Library of Congress cataloging and publication data has been applied for. Warning. This is not a scratch and sniff book. This is critically important information to note. You may scratch the pictures as you please, but the olfactory experience will end there. If you choose to also sniff, please understand that the finished dishes in this cookbook do not smell like paper, nor do they all smell the same, as this might imply. You have been warned. Participation Agreement. By continuing to read this book, you are acknowledging that you have been warned about the lack of scratch and sniff pictures contained in this manuscript. Please read before continuing. The wording on this agreement may not be altered. This agreement constitutes a contract. The conditions of the contract are set forth below. I and or one or more minors for whom I am responsible have decided to engage in one or more of the following activities. The activities. Reading this book without scratch and sniff images. In consideration for myself and or any minors for whom I am responsible being allowed to participate in one or more of the activities, I and any minors for whom I am responsible agree to the following terms. Release from liability. On behalf of myself and any minors for whom I am responsible, I unconditionally release from all liability for any claims for damages, illness, injury, or death relating to participation in any of the activities. This release also encompasses liability relating to negligence. Waiver of right to sue. On behalf of myself and any minors for whom I am responsible, I unconditionally waive the right to sue for damages, illness, injury, or death relating to participation in any of the activities. Savings clause. I agree that if any portion of this agreement is found to be void or unenforceable, the remaining portions shall remain in full force and effect. By continuing, you accept this agreement. Chapters and recipes. The Startup Guide. Setting up your two-slot toaster. An abbreviated history of toasters. The Beginner Recipe List. Room temperature air, hot air, bread, burnt toast, buttered toast with jelly. The advanced recipe list. Toast with cinnamon sugar, toasted English muffins, toasted bagels, waffles with syrup, leftover pizza slices, grilled cheese, warm paninis. The recipe for success. Classic 1643 duck pâté en croûte. The Appendix. about the author. Foreword by adult film actor James Paninas. My favorite memories are always cooking in the kitchen with my family. When I'm overwhelmed, I like to think back to my old kitchen, a glass of wine in hand, cooking up something delicious. Today, out in LA, my kitchen is much smaller and I have to rely on my toaster for so much more. That's why this cookbook stood out to me as special, and it even helped me uncomplicate parts of my life. Now I bring my toaster everywhere I go. It even co-starred in my latest film, James Paninas Does Paninis. It's my understanding that this book wasn't even considered for an IACP, a JBF, or a Gourmand International Cookbook Award. That's disappointing since almost every single one of these dishes is edible. I give this fantastic cookbook 5 out of 5 porn stars. Taste it for yourself. James Paninas, adult film actor, paninas.com. Setting up your 2-slot toaster. Step 1. Plug it in. Optional steps. Carefully count the number of toaster slots, verifying the total is 2. Make sure the plug doesn't fall out of the socket after step number 1. An abbreviated history of toasters. Toasters were unintentionally invented by a couple of cavemen, one of whom we know was named Braden, and that he was the shorter one. It's not known exactly who, but someone, looking at you, Braden, accidentally knocked over 2 pieces of store-bought pre-sliced bread onto a nearby fire. A relaxing campfire with acoustic guitar sing-alongs quickly turned into chaos as they panicked with nobody else around to help, and no cell phone coverage in the area yet. It was absolute hell trying to get the slices out of the flames before they burned. Quite a few swear words were uttered that weren't even invented yet. Finally, using a few sticks and discovering crude tools, they successfully retrieved the slices and plated them with some white Alba truffle garnish. Luckily, the cooked bread slices turned out to be a perfectly toasted brown, henceforth known as a 4. The 2 friends dared each other to still eat the bread after each thought it was ruined. Archaeologists scrutinized their skeletal structure and found evidence of them deciding to each take a bite of the fired bread at the same time, on the count of 3. They would count down and eat it on 0, not 1, as they trepidatiously agreed after a minor back and forth, which their remains showed clearly. When the 2 ultimately ate the whole serving, they decided to call it Tostum, after looking up the word scorch in their handy English to Latin pocket dictionary. Mere moments later, they shortened it to just tossed, or toast, using the modern spelling. One caveman raised his drink and made a heartfelt and touching tribute to the other caveman that also became known as a toast. They didn't have many words back then. Oh, and they probably invented the rest of the 2-slot toaster the next day, sometimes referred to as a toaster. The rest is lost to history. Recipe number 1. Room temperature air. The first step in this recipe is to unplug your toaster. The setup section of this cookbook mere moments ago required you to plug it in and to even double check that it wouldn't fall out. Part of cooking is bending the rules, and the rules need to be bent a little here. Depending on the cooking duration of this dish, you'll want to play it safe by keeping your toaster unplugged, since you may choose to cook this for an extended period, and walk away while it idly prepares. This is entirely up to personal taste and can be completed in seconds, hours, or even days. The world record for this dish's longest cooking period in this style toaster is 893,520 hours, set by Charles Streit in 1921. Note, studies have not shown that a longer cooking time equates to a better result. When finished, carefully tip the toaster over and pour it into a large plate or bowl to serve. This dish goes great before serving appetizers. In fact, many party guests will often pick up a plate of room temperature air and pile on snacks, or mix it with several other appetizers to consume altogether. It pairs well with everything. There's also a way to prepare this dish while leaving your toaster plugged into the wall. Use this method if your toaster is hardwired into your home's electrical circuit. Press the lever down and cancel this action quickly before the toaster's coils warm up. This method requires a bit more skills and, if left too long, may ruin the dish. There are some challenges with this dish, so make yourself aware beforehand. You'll want to have a decent understanding of your home's HVACR system, as it has a huge impact on the outcome of this dish. If your thermostat is set too high, your dish will come out warmer, and if your thermostat is set too low, your dish will come out cooler. Remember that this is all up to personal preference, but the ideal temperature for this dish is between 68 to 72 degrees Fahrenheit, 20 to 22 degrees Celsius. You should also be prepared to compensate for indoor humidity, since that will also play a role in the success of this dish. Again, personal taste, but there are numerous peripheral factors that will change the results of the finished dish. If possible, find your furnace, boiler, and air conditioner owner's manuals, if applicable. Or you can call your local heating and air conditioning company for more information about your system. They will be more than happy to send a tech out to prep you for preparing this recipe. If you'd like to show off a little, you can tell them that refrigerant number R718 is actually just water, and they'll know not to rip you off. Your toaster may or may not be set by the factory to prepare this dish by default. It may even start to prep it without your knowledge. This can be convenient for some, but a nuisance to others. If you've ever found yourself with a mild headache and you're a Sagittarius, check your toaster settings. If it's too high or too low, you may want to turn the dial down to offset the factory settings, even if it's not powered on. You could even choose to unplug it entirely and store it in a cabinet, or at the very least put a toaster cover over it. This solution was discovered by grandmas after their joints seemed to get worse with age. However, not everyone experiences symptoms, and simply turning the toaster's dial may not alleviate all issues. It's best to discuss this with your doctor and mention error code number B07RT8 LLSP, which will give them the most relevant information for a diagnosis on the spot. Not to fear, most people will not have life-threatening issues with this dish, and many will not even experience life-altering issues. So put on your favorite PPE and enjoy this dish with friends, family, and friends of the family. Warning, do not microwave room temperature air, as it may do serious and unrepairable damage to your microwave appliance. Please only prepare room temperature air using a toaster oven or toaster oven. Prop 65. Warning, room temperature air is known in the state of California to cause birth defects or other reproductive harm. Recipe number 2, hot air. For recipe number 2, we need to unbend the rules from the last dish. Please plug your toaster back into the wall securely. You may want to revisit this book's setup guide and consider recounting the toaster slots to verify it's still 2 and double-checking that the plug will not fall out of the socket. The hot air dish requires you to crank up the toaster to its maximum setting, so turn the knob all the way to 10. If your toaster only goes up to 5, then you may want to try to pull the knob off and turn it another full rotation before putting it back on. This will unlock the 10 setting on your substandard toaster. If your toaster has a bagel setting, make sure that setting is turned off. There may be remnants of the room temperature air dish still lingering inside your toaster. This is fine, and it will not negatively affect your hot air dish. If your friendly neighborhood HVACR technician is still at your home, or maybe backing out of your driveway, go get him and have him come back inside to help you again. Or perhaps you feel you possess the required knowledge of your home's central air, ductless, geothermal, heat pump, fireplace, pellet stove, or boiler system in order to utilize that system for the enhancement of this dish. Make sure to wash your hands after tinkering with your home's heating system to avoid cross-contamination with any food or cooking surfaces in your kitchen. If you didn't wash your hands in Chapter 1, you should consider washing them twice in this chapter to offset that prior miscalculation. Moving on, this common dish is incredibly popular in Washington, D.C., and they're specifically known for making it every day of the week. In fact, this is the unofficial ceremonious dish made at each session of Congress. It's also quite popular at state capitals as well. There have also been many businesses that made themselves known for selling this dish to hot air balloon enthusiasts on an industrial level. You don't need to be a lighter-than-air LTA-certified hot air balloon aeronaut pilot to enjoy this fantastic recipe, though. It can be appreciated by everyone. As a side effect of cooking this dish, you may experience your surroundings becoming a bit balmier. This is nothing to be worried about, and no, you're probably not hallucinating. This might be an issue for some, but others embrace this reaction by cooking this dish first and then continuing on to cooking more complex dishes next. This approach allows the kitchen to become comfy and warm before spending more time in there making longer dishes. It's always more comfortable to cook in a warmer kitchen than in a cold one, so start with this dish and enjoy. This dish is done when you can't hold your hand over the two slots of the toaster, but again, this is subjective and comes down to personal taste. Some prefer to just cook warm air, a similar dish but with a little less bite. This cookbook skips the warm air recipe for geopolitical reasons, but an astute reader may be able to ascertain the full recipe using context clues from this chapter. Anyway, serve by tipping your toaster on its side and pouring it onto a large plate or bowl. Note, this dish will cool down quickly, so you'll want to serve it as soon as possible after it's plated. Pair this hot air dish with hot air, the drink, by simply pouring it from your toaster into a cup or glass and serving it with a straw. Warning: do not microwave hot air, as it may also do serious and unrepairable damage to your microwave appliance. Please only prepare hot air using a toaster, oven, or toaster oven. Prop 65. Warning: hot air is known in the state of California to cause birth defects or other reproductive harm. Recipe number 3. Bread. This recipe is going to take us back to our roots. If you planted bread seed last season, then you can take that literally, since the root of the bread plant is exactly what we need to start this dish. Believe it or not, Jesus Christ fed more than 5,000 people with mostly bread. So we're definitely going way back for this miraculous recipe. Quick, grab your toaster and set it to the number of other gods before me, 0. This simple setting allows you to insert a slice or two of bread into the toaster, and it cooks the perfect bread. Now, if you don't have a garden with fresh bread to pluck up, you can simply unbag a couple of slices from your kitchen's bread box and toss those in the toaster. Store-bought pre-sliced bread is usually a bit more artificial than fresh from the garden, but in a pinch, it's certainly an acceptable solution. Note the firmness of the slices as you slide them into the slots. You'll want to recreate this by the end of the cooking process. Once the slices have been fully inserted into the toaster, it's time to take them out, making sure you did not turn the toaster on during the insertion process. Note the firmness of the slices as you slide them out of the slots. How well did you do to recreate it compared to the beginning of the cooking process? Hopefully they're close. You should seriously consider employing a teammate to verify the correct firmness of the finished bread by asking them the following questions. Question 1. Is this the correct firmness? If they answered in the affirmative, the cooking process was a success. If they answer in the anti-affirmative, then you may decide to start from scratch, depending on how far off your teammate deems your finished product. Tip: you might consider paying your teammate for a positive review of your firmness to avoid restarting the entire cooking process. The mathematical formula you should employ when considering this option is as follows: MVB times 2 plus L times EA. Whereas MVB is the market value of a slice of bread, and L is the cost of labor for cooking the recipe once. Do not substitute liters or length for L. This will potentially result in penalty yards added to the next attempt or try. EA is the estimated number of attempts you will need to get the recipe right. If you want to be more specific, you can multiply the rate of inflation in the U.S. against how long you think it'll take you to get this recipe right, if more than a day, which will help you plan your bribe more carefully in today's hectic economy. Author's note: the redundant parenthesis in the previous formula is included due to the general lack of understanding of PEMDAs in the U.S. The overall integrity of this cookbook will not be compromised by nescience. So, if you're going to pay off your reviewer by utilizing this formula, please make sure not to exceed the dollar value result of the above equation. This is called a cost-benefit analysis formula, and will help to make sure you don't spend more money on bribes than you would for simply starting over on the recipe. This is a good equation to use elsewhere as well. By changing some inputs, you can calculate bribes for most industries, for work or personal endeavors. Once your consulting team is satisfied with the resulting firmness of your bread, simply plate it and serve. Outside of the mathematics, this dish is actually quite simple, and if you get it right on the first try, you can avoid the math altogether. This cookbook hasn't covered any toppings yet, but if you're daring and would like a preview, you could carefully try to squirt some ketchup onto your finished dish to create ketchup bread. Ketchup is one of the easiest condiments to apply, so it's reasonable to expect a novice chef to apply it without the use of spreading knives. So take a chance here and try turning this dish into something extra. Ketchup bread is commonly enjoyed in America after dining out and consuming hamburgers or cheeseburgers. It's sort of a grand finale like you'd enjoy at the end of a fireworks display. Ketchup bread is what's left over after the burger patty is consumed, but there's still some bun and ketchup left to eat at the end. Instead of making a full-on hamburger or cheeseburger, just fast forward to the good part by putting ketchup on this bread recipe and skip the meat entirely. Lastly, it definitely should have been noted earlier, but please be certain to use tomato ketchup for the topping as other chemical ketchup toppings could result in bodily harm. If you think you've consumed a non-tomato-based ketchup, NTBK, please consult the safety data sheet for the chemical consumed. NTBKs are a serious issue, and legislatures across the country should soon enact stricter ketchup rules, public awareness, and product guidelines through the FDA. Recipe number 4. Burnt toast. This popular dish is made by many at big dinner events with lots going on in the kitchen. This dish is simple and can be cooked in the background while focusing on other things in the kitchen. Just let it sit, and you'll know when it's done because the burnt toast detectors will beep loudly. Most houses are required to have burnt toast detectors installed per their municipality's building code due to the popularity of this common dish. Time to use your toaster for its full potential. Be sure to contact your electrical gas utility provider first due to the demand on the power grid that this dish sometimes can create. If you have a natural gas-powered toaster, you may want to contact your gas electrical utility provider for the same reason. Sometimes it's best to plan this dish for non-peak usage hours. Expect a reasonable increase in your utility bill at month's end. Start by turning the toaster setting up to 10. As stated before, if your toaster dial only goes up to 5, you'll have to remove the dial and rotate it another 360 degrees, clockwise, before putting it back onto the toaster. Once again, this unlocks the 10 setting and will help you achieve the maximum burntiness of your toast. This dish is commonly and incorrectly referred to as burnt toast, but in fact, the dish is actually made by burning bread. This means that step 2 in this recipe is to take 2 slices of the bread we approved in the previous recipe and insert them back into the toaster. Due to constraints in optimizing SEO for this cookbook, the recipe title has to conform to the most popular terminology, and so this chapter will remain titled Burnt Toast. With your pre-made sliced bread inserted into the toaster and the toaster's dial set to 10, press down on the lever and let the bread cook. No need to set a timer since your home's burnt toast alarms will tell you when this dish is nearly done. Be warned that this dish can start a house fire since the burning bread can ultimately be cooked indefinitely. So a good rule of thumb is to remove the finished burnt toast sometime between the alarms beeping and the house burning down, often referred to as ut o'clock. Please have a fire blanket in the kitchen at the ready if you plan to push the envelope on this recipe. Scientists have been able to push this dish to its absolute limits by using a controlled environment to cook bread well past its normal physical and chemical boundaries. This super-extended burn, SEB, actually changes the overall chemistry of the burnt toast so much that it's no longer bread, toast, or even burnt. Using oven mitts, remove the finished slices of burnt toast, plate, and serve. No condiments necessary. They wouldn't be able to compete with the overwhelming smoky flavor anyway. You'd be wasting your money. The burning of bread or toast creates polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAH, which is a toxic carcinogen. It also creates acrylamide, which is a toxic carcinogen as well. Both can cause cancer in humans, not just in California, but in all 52 states. PAH and acrylamides are so toxic that they create degenerative changes in the brain, heart, liver, and kidneys. The higher the exposure, the more likely tumors are to develop per the Toxicology and Applied Pharmacology Journal. You should probably consider ripping these pages out of the cookbook and burning them instead. Just don't eat them afterward. What an incredible turn of events, a cookbook that requires you to burn part of the book as the last step in the recipe. This is some Mission Impossible type stuff. You really did find the most cutting-edge cookbook to ever exist. Good for you, well done. Recipe number 5, toast. Regular old, nothing crazy, boring, who really cares, toast. Bread and toaster, push down lever, don't burn, eat. Next recipe. Congratulations on your successful completion of the Making Regular Toast certification program. You can cut out the award from this book or visit the website to print a high-res version, a2slottoaster.com/award.html. Now, please literally brace yourself for something just a little more advanced. Recipe number 6. Buttered toast. Buttered toast. Noun. Okay, now that you've mastered the toast recipe, we can move on to the much more complex, interesting, and challenging buttered toast. So start by going back to the toast recipe once more and prepare 2 slices for this dish before continuing to the next step. Use the specific information you gained on the previous recipe and utilize your certified toaster skills. Remember, be careful not to put the toaster setting too low or you'll accidentally make bread. Also, be careful not to put the toaster setting too high or you'll accidentally make burnt toast. These recipes now call for finesse, so it's important to be confident and trust yourself as you move further forward into this cookbook. Step number 2 is the step that separates the boys from the men, the girls from the women, and the non-binary from the non-binarier. It is now time to go and get a knife. Introducing knives is dangerous, so seeking out some sick professional knife skills online is encouraged. For non-commercial applications, wearing personal protective equipment is not strictly required, but is very much recommended. Commercial butterers must wear all required PPE in accordance with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, standards in the United States of America. This includes all of the following: cut-proof gloves, cut-resistant sleeves, cut-repellent aprons, cut-deterring chaps, cut-discouraging non-slip leather shoes, thick-ass safety glasses or face shields, and cut-admonishing jock straps for the gentlemen. Now, it is finally possible to safely operate the butter knife. Just watch out for your unprotected neck area, which is still quite vulnerable to Sindar elves. The butter knife is the flat one with a rounded blade designed to spread soft butter across a surface. Specialty butter knives have tiny holes along the edge of the blade that will spread even the hardest of soft butters. It is highly recommended to purchase this specialty blade from your local metalsmith, swordsman, or sabermater. Once you get your hands on this top-of-the-line knife, you'll want to try flipping the knife in the air and catching it on the hilt. Start by trying to simply do 1 rotation in the air and graduate your flips to 2 or more rotations while airborne before catching it. Remember, we're flipping and catching a knife. This is very dangerous because if we drop it on the floor, it becomes dirty and we'll have to find another knife to flip around. The more rotations in the air, the greater the danger. The rest is quite simple, and you can follow the mathematical recipe in the book using the nomenclature provided for reference as follows: thickness of bread, thickness of butter, specific heat capacity at constant pressure for bread, specific heat capacity at constant pressure for butter, density of bread, density of butter, temperature of toasted bread, weight of butter. The result of this simple equation will yield the best buttered toast you've ever eaten in your entire life, bar none. Science has proven this by error and trial, then finally by trial and error. If you have a pen and paper handy, you should write that down for future reference. Actually, you should go back and write everything down from this cookbook so far, then you will have it handy at a glance, and you'll also have roughly 1.285 copies of this cookbook, which is a better bargain for the price you paid for just one book by itself. Go look in the mirror and give yourself a thumbs up. You earned it. Congratulations once again on your successful completion of the buttered toast certification. This is the second level of cooking with a 2-slot toaster. You're well on your way to being accepted into a collegiate-level culinary program. You can cut out the award from this book or visit the website to print a high-res version, a2slottoaster.com/award.html. Feel free to submit this certificate to the college of your choice, along with your application or transfer documents. You're finally ready for the ultimate 2-slot toaster recipe. Recipe number 7, buttered toast with jelly. Don't freak out. Calm down. Just breathe. Remember what we went over in the last chapter. Think of your breathing and stay relaxed. The additional complexities of this dish require a sound mind, quick thinking, split-second reaction times, and unparalleled key decision-making abilities. Frankly, it takes courage above all else. Set your worries aside and clean your toaster's crumb tray. Messy crumb tray, messy mind. Set your toaster to the desired level using the available settings of 2 through 9, once again being careful not to cook the incorrect dish. Setting 1 might only cook bread, and setting 10 will almost always cook burnt toast. Once again, we're assuming you have a toaster with settings up to 10. If you have a toaster that only goes to 5, you will have to multiply these instructions by 2. If you have a toaster that has a maximum number that isn't 10 or 5, you can use this handy cross-multiplication formula below to find the correct levels. C times M divided by 10. In the above formula, let C equal the stated cookbook toaster level given in the directions, and let M equal the maximum setting on your personal toaster. Please be careful with these variables. Do not weigh your toaster and input the mass as M, which might throw the recipe off by a lot. You should also be extra careful not to use the speed of light as the C variable, because then your recipe will be off by about 50 million. If you really want to get this formula wrong, you could plug in coulombs for C and multiply that by meters for M, which results in 10,000. However, this formula is quite similar to the specific heat capacity formula, which is also relevant, but you would need to know the difference in temperature in order to complete the equation. That being said, if you correctly followed the previous recipe, you would have calculated this variable already. Refer to your notes from Chapter 6 if you'd like to continue here for extra credit. By the way, if you like math and toast, try graphing these two equations and you'll be pleasantly surprised. X minus 2 times 1,000 plus Y 1,000 equals 1. X plus 2 times 1,000 plus Y 1,000 equals 1. Now, after all that math, you'll want to attain a knife again. Spreading jelly is no small task and requires many more knife skills than spreading butter with a specialty knife. No, there's nothing special to be found here, just a flat, boring, dull blade and a slippery substance some call jam. Take a few moments now to attempt to flip this new spreading knife 4 full rotations in the air before catching it. This is the only true way to know that you're ready for the next big step. If you have lower ceilings in your kitchen, you may instead try to just simply flip 1 rotation, but close your eyes whilst doing so. Once the proper tools are on hand, the spreading can commence. For the successful spreading of the jelly, it comes down to a simple technique that will allow the spreader to achieve the highest quality result. Let's begin with your feet spread comfortably, shoulder width apart, in second position. Note that the spreading of our feet will encourage a nice spreading of the jelly. Next, stand comfortably relaxed with your hips centered over your feet and bend your legs very slightly so as not to restrict the circulation through your lower extremities. Keep your arms loose at your sides and your relaxed shoulders above your hips without any tension. Be soft, like the jelly. Take a few deep breaths. Fill your mighty lungs with air, hold, and release smoothly into the atmosphere. Be smooth like the jelly. Close your eyes and imagine you are the jelly. Realize that when you open your eyes, you're just simply spreading yourself on the toast, and the knife is just an extension of your jelly body becoming one with the toast. You find yourself spreading your body completely into the toast. You've fused with the toast and the dish is complete. You've transcended the recipe completely. In fact, you no longer need to consume the toast with jelly because you've absorbed the dish through your jelly appendage while reaching this moment of zen. Your needs are met. You are a whole person. A whole. You are one. You wake up to your alarm clock beeping at you loudly and getting louder. You're groggy, but still know it's weird because you only use your smartphone for alarms now. You open your eyes and reach over to shut it off. The cool air outside your blanket bites at your slightly sweaty forearm. It's suddenly peaceful in the dark room. Your mother is knocking at your bedroom door across the room and asks if you're all right, her voice muffled by the closed wooden door. She mentions that your alarm clock was going off for a really long time. You suddenly realize you're going to be late if you don't get out of bed right now. Your bare feet hit the matted carpet loosely attached to the subfloor when you realize that you haven't lived in your parents' house in forever. What the hell is going on? Did you just dream the last several years of your life? Or are you dreaming right now? You get dressed while trying to shake the odd feeling before walking down the stairwell of your old family home. The step that creaks the most is still the last one. You sit down at the kitchen table for breakfast as usual, and plated in front of you is a pair of the most perfectly buttered and jellied pieces of golden brown toast you've ever seen in your entire life. You and your breakfast levitate. Congratulations once again on your successful completion of the Making Toast with Jelly certification program. You can cut out the award from this book or visit the website to print a high-res version, a2slottoaster.com/award.html. This is the final step in the preparation of standard toast dishes. You are a master of toast. A Toastmaster. You are now free to finish any recipe in this cookbook with butter and/or jelly. Recipe number 8. Hot inside parts of a toaster. Start by plugging in your toaster and turning it up all the way. Just kidding. This chapter is a joke. The rest of this book has been very serious, but this chapter is meant to be funny and lighten the mood. Hopefully it caught you by surprise and gave you something you didn't expect, like Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. That movie hangs its hat on unpredictable incidents. In fact, it brings enough hats to hang up for a few unexpected outcomes in every scene. Perhaps this is because the previous movie was too predictable, so they overreacted with tons of erratic curveballs. Like when General Hux is the butt of every joke now, and unlike the previous movie, he's used primarily as comic relief. Or like when Luke tosses his old lightsaber away humorously, a scene that was set up so dramatically as a conclusion to the previous film. Nope, it's funny now. He could have simply dropped it on the ground for the same effect, or just handed it back to Rey. But instead, Luke changes character traits for the first time in the entire saga and chooses to be whimsical. This should have been accompanied by a funny sound effect to drive it home. Or like when Leia seemingly dies in an explosion and is sucked out into space. Nope, she wakes up and just flies back into the ship. And when she is let back into the ship, without an airlock, nobody got sucked out into space either. It's also a good thing someone was watching for her to come back and could see her specifically among the debris in space too, or else she might have run out of air waiting at the door from holding her breath for 2 minutes in the vacuum of space. Or like when Rey's parents turned out to be nobodies. This was the biggest question people had before this movie was released, and we finally get into this huge build in the dark cave to find out, well, we can't tell what we found out until Kylo discloses that they were nobodies and are dead. That's it. Nothing to see here, folks. Sorry we made you get your hopes up for some big reveal. Or like when everyone got super interested in the newly introduced Snoke character and thought about who he was and how he came to power in some fascinating character reveal. Nope again. He's just dead now. Once more, something was set up for the audience and then tossed directly into the overflowing garbage can of audience expectations. Snoke wasn't special, and neither were Rey's parents. Captain Phasma wasn't special either. She got hit in the face by Finn and is also dead now. Didn't see that coming, did you? A whole bunch of nobodies. It's as if the directors of the movies didn't plan anything out and also didn't like each other at all. Or like how the Force is used in crazy, new, and convenient ways now. Force users can talk to each other from anywhere in the galaxy, and it appears that physical matter can even transport from one to another, too. This happens when Kylo sees his glove is wet after talking to Rey, who was near water. We also see Luke use the Force in a brand new way when he sends a hologram to meet Kylo. But the two can't physically interact, however. Leia can touch hologram Luke and hold onto the hologram dice Luke handed her. But yet when Kylo and Rey talk to each other, they can definitely touch each other's hands. Also, with Leia, Force users can fly in space now too. 3 huge Force revelations in a single movie, and none are consistent or clearly defined. If the characters are going to have superpowers, they need to have rules or general guidelines for the viewer to have an understanding of the continuity. Otherwise, the script could, and does, call for the characters to do literally anything at all. Or like when we're built up to understand that there's only one master codebreaker in the entire galaxy that can help out our 2 would-be heroes, Finn and Rose. But every single time, nope. It turns out they fail and get thrown into a cell with someone who just so happens to be another master codebreaker that can help them. Holy moly. Didn't expect that, did you? He also decided not to break himself out of the cell for some reason. Maybe he was too tired from all the code breaking he'd been up to prior and needed a nap in the holding cell first. Not for nothing, but Finn and Rose are the 2 most serendipitously lucky people in the entire movie. They lucked themselves into a second master codebreaker mere seconds after finding the first one that unknowingly waited for them and could then break them out of their holding cell. They then luckily found a human-sized sewer grate in the jail's hallway just a few steps away, with a lid that wasn't bolted down so they could effortlessly escape. What a massive oversight in the design of the holding cells. Then luckily, the random vagabond master codebreaker didn't abandon them, found a ship, and somehow found them after they miraculously didn't get hurt riding those animals through walls. Then, even though their newfound friend double-crossed them, the stormtroopers decide to be dramatic and try to make their death more painful instead of just killing them off. But yet they survive this even when the weapons are literally touching the hair on their heads. Then, when Admiral Holdo sacrifices herself, so many stormtroopers are shown having been killed, but not our two lucky little scamps in the middle of it all. They, of course, survive. And finally, luckily, Captain Phasma is distracted and doesn't just shoot them herself, and Finn is able to win in hand-to-hand combat against her. Should have shot him when she had the chance. Darn it. Or like when Finn is driving so far ahead of the other pilots in his ground skimmer, straight into the big cannon, and Rose somehow catches up to crash into him perpendicularly so that he doesn't sacrifice himself, then gives him a little smooch. Betcha didn't expect either of those things. By the way, let's continue their luck trajectory where neither of them are destroyed by the enemy in battle while piloting their ground-skimming crafts. Then neither of them are killed in the high-speed crash into one another. Without it being shown on camera, Finn luckily was able to carry Rose all the way back to the base without being attacked by the First Order when walking past them. It was also a considerably long distance away, too. Those ground-skimmers were going fast over a long period of time. Finn flew right up to the cannon, then walked back to the base in pretty much an equal amount of screen time. Or like our expectation of how fast spacecraft can move in this fictional universe. Apparently, for the sake of the script, the First Order ships can't just go a tiny bit faster. If they could, there'd be no movie. Also, after seven previous main Star Wars films, we're finally introduced to fuel, a plot device on which this movie hinges its entire script, all 2 hours and 30 minutes of it. It's tough to say what was more riveting, the manufactured slow crawl chase scenes in space or the appendage of a B-story at the casino filled with parking enforcement outside and a master codebreaker convention inside. It's a super time-sensitive mission, but we absolutely need to take a good chunk of that time to connect with the poor children and try to save the animals. They added appendages to the appendages. Furthermore, Poe Dameron would have been dishonorably discharged, or whatever the resistance equivalent is, for the countless times he disobeyed orders. Right off the bat, he got nearly everyone killed leading an attack that General Leia ordered to stop. He practically disobeys orders in every single scene in which he appears. After Leia gets tired from flying through space, Vice Admiral Holdo takes over command. It's doubtful that a vice admiral answers to a captain, by the way, but Poe seems to push her for explanations that he is certainly not owed. She outranks him so much that he didn't even know what she looked like before meeting her in this film. He's only ever heard of her impressive past record. However, on her side, it was bad leadership to withhold a simple yet critical plan from everyone for feeble, made-up reasons. Again, at the same time, Poe doesn't need to know the plan. He's not in charge, and he shouldn't even be on the bridge of the ship. He's not a commander anymore since he got demoted for getting most of his fleet killed. By the end, they even laugh it off and forgive him for a mutiny that should probably have been punishable by death. Incidentally, during a mutiny, people are usually put into a holding cell or a brig, preferably without human-sized loose sewer grates, and they definitely don't get to keep their weapons. Holdo gets out because of this major oversight. This is probably a good thing because with Poe at the helm, he might have sent another ragtag duo to a different casino planet to find someone with even rarer skills to try to help them. It's surprising that after all the misdirection in this movie, they didn't zoom in on Vice Admiral Holdo after she sacrificed herself to show that she survived the lightspeed collision and landed the remaining bits of the ship safely at the planet's base with the others. Or maybe Rose could have crashed into her at the last lightspeed millisecond to prevent Holdo from sacrificing herself too. Maybe even giving her a little smooch afterward too. The First Order should have just blasted every resistance ship the moment General Hux gave the command and his dreadnought was in position, 3 minutes into the film. The runtime for this movie would have been under 10 minutes long, and most of that would have been the First Order filling out debrief paperwork and reloading a few shots back into their cannons. Instead, Hux gets interrupted by a single enemy fighter and immediately tells the pilot that there will be no terms or surrender. If that's the case, then why even talk to the pilot in the first place? Just shoot him. He's even sitting still for crying out loud. They were going to kill them all anyway. Fire away. And who just lets random little ships come up and talk directly to the enemy's general? Once again, Hux has to be at the receiving end of every joke, and if he doesn't let the pilot speak, we wouldn't be able to include a yo mama joke in the opening of this space-based romantic comedy flick. Romantic due to Rose kissing Finn, of course. What a fun place to go with such a valuable and historic movie franchise. By creating so many unexpected outcomes, this movie becomes a parody of an action movie. It takes viewers out of the movie world each scene, so much so that it turns you around and becomes more of a movie about an audience who is watching an unrealistic, over-the-top movie. You're taken out so far that you're placed behind yourself in some sort of parallel parody reality. Reality? A movie with one or maybe two unexpected small events can make things a bit interesting. Sometimes, besides the cliche hero barely survives trope. But when every single scene is set up and then knocked down, it becomes the script that cried wolf. Last and certainly least, The Last Jedi did not include even one toaster droid, better known as an MSE-6 series repair droid. We're told this is the distant future from when we first saw these droids on the silver screen, and yet instead of evolving into giant toaster-like end-boss people droids, they were actually removed entirely. This is the biggest blunder in the entire film, and frankly the only one that can't be forgiven. It's possible to look past most of the issues in Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, but not including toaster droids is simply a bridge too far. Real recipe number 8, toast with cinnamon sugar. Note, our lawyers have informed us that you are not allowed to make this recipe crunchy in any way. If your dish crunches, we are liable for a lawsuit against General Mills Cereal and their primary shareholding company, Vanguard Group. Please keep your toast soft for this recipe and set your toaster's dial below level 2 or 3 before continuing any further. For this recipe, you will need freshly made soft buttered toast, refer to previous chapters as needed, and cinnamon sugar, preferably not on every bite. You should probably avoid swirling it too, just to be safe. Before taking the next step, please be certain your spoons are put away securely in their drawer and that they will not be anywhere near the completed cinnamon toast when finished. This is to guarantee that this breakfast dish is not consumed similarly to a cereal. Now we can either do this the easy way or the hard way. The easy way is to upend the cinnamon sugar container and sprinkle a decent amount of the delicious topping onto the buttered toast. A light dusting should cover most of the toast while also getting a little bit on the countertop or table. Wipe all the cinnamon that didn't at least make it on the plate directly onto the floor and forget about it. If you're married, make sure to do this inconspicuously to avoid relationship problems down the road. Now, if you've selected the hard way, hold the buttered toast above the cinnamon sugar container and jolt them both upward at the same time so that the cinnamon sugar coats the underside of the toast. As some falls back down to the table, you can then proceed to wipe the overage onto the floor. Again, take care to look over your shoulder first if needed. Your relationship will depend on this safety glance. After coating the underside of the toast, you'll now need to consume it upside down, so take that into consideration before choosing to prepare this dish the hard way, because you'll also have to eat it the hard way as well. Continue by taking a quick peek at your cinnamon container, making sure you didn't just decorate your delicious morsel with ground cinnamon by mistake, since that would ruin this dish completely, and at this point, it would be much too late to fix it. Making certain you didn't make that mistake previously, you can continue with the directions. When plating, please take a moment to verify that this dish will not be served in or on a bowl. Actually, it should also not be served adjacent to a bowl, since doing so would be akin to perjury based on our testimony at the previous trial about the future of our publications and resulting products. This dish pairs well with orange juice and apple juice, as a matter of fact. Most, if not all, juices go great with this unique dish, a dish that isn't based on anything similar in the breakfast food market already. You may also simply enjoy water while chowing down. Try to avoid drinking milk with this recipe, though, because if there are cinnamon toast remnants in your mouth while you drink milk, it might be misconstrued as cereal, and that would not look good in a court of law, especially if the prosecution uses the same counsel as last time. No, that would be a nightmare again. All that being said, please enjoy this legally distinct cinnamon toast breakfast meal. It may be helpful to not mention that you even made it. If anybody asks, you didn't get the recipe from this cookbook. This is also not part of a balanced breakfast, so please don't indicate that in any way, or say that phrase aloud, or imply it in any shape or form. You'd be much better off keeping your mouth shut about everything you just read if you know what's good for you. This is an explicit written threat. Recipe number 9, Toasted English Muffins. This is a very simple recipe. It's been included so late in the cookbook because it does require a little bit of driving skills that some young chefs may not possess yet, or may not be old enough to become licensed to possess yet. Once you're licensed to operate a motor vehicle in your municipality, please proceed to step 1 of this English muffin recipe. Please note that this recipe is not for American muffins, and as such, the directions will be using British terminology that may differ from American English in vocabulary or pronunciation. Step 1. Unlatch the bonnet of your auto and check for safe levels of fluids for the motor to function. These fluids include the brake fluid, motor oil, gearbox fluid, coolant, windscreen fluid, and power steering fluid. Before getting in, you'll also want to do a walkabout to check for things like damage, tire wear, and nearby obstacles. Please also check all lamps are in working order, such as brakes, headlamps, running lamps, high beams, and turn lamps. You may need a mate to help you verify the brake lamps. You'll also need to verify that your number plate is registered and has a working illuminating lamp installed. Now, you may enter your auto using the driver's side door and situate yourself behind the steering wheel. The first thing you should do upon entering is to fasten your safety belt, then you may adjust the seat to a comfortable position. Press or turn the ignition and verify petrol levels, and also that no warnings are illuminated. Be careful not to tick over too long, especially if you're inside a garage, pronounced garage, as the fumes are dangerous when inhaled. Putting the auto into reverse gear, you should safely reverse out onto the motorway. Be certain to continually check all mirrors as you back up. You may proceed to follow the motorway to the nearest McDonald's restaurant. Note, English junctions do not allow you to turn right on red, so if you'd like to follow this recipe authentically, you should wait until the traffic signal is green before turning. When you arrive at the popular fast food restaurant, you'll want to continue past the car park and into the drive-thru. Use caution not to hit the curb or bollards, as lanes can be tight and very close to the building's facade. English muffins, normally a breakfast food, are part of the McDonald's breakfast menu. As such, these items are only available in the morning hours of the day, so make it a point to leave early, or else this dish may have to be postponed to a later date. Provided you've arrived before the cutoff, you may continue this recipe by ordering aloud, 1 egg McMuffin sandwich, please. This recipe requires some money as an ingredient, so have that ready for the next step. When requested, you may add about 1/8 cup of U.S. quarter dollar coins to the dish, more if using smaller coins. Again, this recipe is easy. The employee you've just met will also inform you how much of the money ingredient is required at this step specifically. Even better, if you put too much of this ingredient into the dish, they will give you back the overage with a printout of how much ingredient was used. It is practically impossible to mess this step up. Nearly immediately after adding this single ingredient, you'll be handed a bag with a nicely toasted English muffin inside. The final step in this recipe is to open the bag and unwrap the English muffin. Discard the egg, cheese, and Canadian bacon so you may enjoy your freshly made toasted English muffin. Recipe number 10, Toasted Bagels. For this recipe, you'll need the following items: a bagel, a bagel slicer, a toaster, a bagel setting on the toaster, electricity, and a mouth and hands and stuff. Without even one of these items, the odds of completing this dish approach zero. A study has shown that when laboratory rats are given all but one of these ingredients, less than 1% could complete the dish, and the single rat that completed it coincidentally brought his own bagel from home. Of course, you could replace some of these ingredients with other similar items. Instead of a bagel, you could use a bialy. Instead of a bagel slicer, you could use a sharp knife. Maybe you could swap the toaster for a pan. The bagel setting could just be you not flipping the bialy on the pan, and without electricity, a gas stove works just fine. Lastly, if you don't have a mouth and hands and stuff, you could simply use your other appendages to cook, and a feeding tube can bypass your mouth. See, There's always another option. No problem is unsolvable. Except for the Birch and Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, that one is freaking impossible to figure out. This does bring up the Ship of Theseus philosophical question, though. If you replaced all the ingredients with something else, did you really make a toasted bagel? Or Hecate, which asks what specifically makes a toasted bagel to begin with? What part of the recipe specifically makes this dish this dish? To answer these questions, the next step in this recipe is to enroll in a collegiate philosophy program, preferably at a well-known school with a good football program. You're looking for a major specifically called cognitive science. General philosophy would probably cover what this cookbook needs you to know, but the more specific, the better. You definitely don't need to worry about a master's degree or PhD. A simple BA will work just fine. Feel free to continue into graduate school or postgraduate school if you'd like, but it will not affect this dish's result or taste. After the previous prep work is complete, you can start by using a bagel slicer to split the bagel in half. Do not flip the bagel slicer in the air as it may land on the bagel and cut it an unintended direction. The proper cut should be done vertically so that you have two sections that look like the letter O, as opposed to perpendicularly, which would result in two sections that look like the letter C. If you end up with any parts of the cut bagel that resemble the letter W, you'll need to start this recipe from the beginning and try again. Now take your sliced bagel halves and insert them into the toaster's slots with the flat side facing inward at one another. Out of all the steps in all the recipes of this cookbook, this one is possibly the most beneficial. Find the bagel setting on the toaster and enable it. This will prevent the toaster from toasting the rounded side of the bagel, which is the side showing the Maillard reaction. The Maillard reaction is not an important part of this step, so you do not need to attain a food science degree to continue this recipe. To quickly explain, if your child complains that they don't like crust, what they actually mean to say is that they don't like the Maillard reaction. Shame on them. Anyway, set the desired toastiness level and press down on your toaster's lever to complete the dish. When the toaster pops the bagel slices up, it may scare you and/or your cat. So approach with caution. You should also be warned that thick-ass bagel slices may not pop up all the way and should be removed with great care. As tempting as it may be to retrieve this delicious meal with a knife, do not do it. A metal knife could complete the electrical circuit from the plug's neutral and hot wires and would result in electrocution, named after electrical execution, of course. You do not want to be toasted by your toaster. This would also kill the toaster, so again, do not do this. Remove the slices by hand and be prepared for their extreme heat. They were just toasted at up to 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Plate this dish and, using your previous experiences, add butter, jelly, cinnamon sugar, or even explore new things such as cream cheese or peanut butter. Recipe number 11, waffles with syrup. You can toast almost anything that will fit in the two slots of a toaster. If you like graphing paper, then you'll love this recipe. Making waffles with syrup in a toaster is like eating a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet for breakfast. You can even plot data using the syrup. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. First, we have to make the waffles by opening up the package of frozen pre-made waffles. Remember, you bought these a while ago, and they've been sitting at the bottom of your freezer for some time now. Don't worry, they're still good, but we kinda need to make them right now so they don't expire. There's nothing quite like mandatory breakfast. Also, make sure when you bought them a while ago, you didn't get the circle ones. This recipe's math is all based on square waffles, and circle waffles require the use of pi. While this chapter will touch on Euclidean geometry, it will not focus on anything except square waffles, specifically 4x4 squares. Pi is also not a breakfast dish, nor is it relevant to toasters, which are rectangles. If you'd like to learn more about pi and circles, you may be interested in the next chapter where we use math to warm up leftover dinner food. Slide the two waffles into the two slots of the toaster. Make sure the toaster isn't upside down. You don't want to slide the toaster down onto the upright waffles. This will prevent them from popping up when they're done. Or if you have a particularly well-made German toaster, it may pop your waffles right through the countertop. Set the toaster to the desired level, keeping in mind that they just came from the freezer, and you'll need to compensate for how cold they currently are. Use the helpful formula below to determine the toaster setting offset for frozen waffles, S plus 2. Let S equal the setting you would normally choose for unfrozen food. You should also remember that soft waffles are preferred by most, so the goal is to find the gigantic Goldilocks zone between frozen and burnt. When done, stack your waffles on a plate and let the fun begin. Now, before we move on, we need to take a moment to seriously discuss the most dangerous ingredient in this cookbook. This chemical stems from the Acer saccharum, a member of Sapindaceae, which is made up of two monosaccharides that form a disaccharide, or a high molecular weight polysaccharide in this specific example. This chemical is infamous for hydrogen bonding because of its 8 hydroxyl groups. When dihydrogen monoxide, DHMO, is added to this chemical, it adheres to the solute molecules, which are also jagged and pointy, and everything becomes more viscous. In the end, we're left with an extremely sticky chemical called grade A maple syrup. Take all precautions when working with this chemical. If it gets on your clothes or tablecloth, it may create a permanent bond and destroy them. Please wear the necessary PPE when working with any chemicals. Using the 4x4 waffle grid, there are 216, or exactly 65,536 unique bitonal image variations of how you can pour the syrup over your finished dish. The syrup is like the Excel true or false data being entered into the cells of the waffle. With syrup being a true or false variable, we can do if statements for breakfast. What fun! We can also add other formulas to make ingesting the data simpler and more efficient. For example, if you wanted to quickly add syrup to the entire waffle, you could simply enter the data into just cell A1 and then drag the corner of the cell down through cell D4 instead of pouring the slow, viscous semi-liquid out of the sticky container. However, if you want all the cells to always match A1, even if A1 changes in the future, you'll need to write a more specific if statement. This formula could be accomplished a couple of different ways, but the most common way is to use the following logical function, equals if. A1 equals true, comma, true, comma, false. The statement before the parentheses is the function, and the next sequence before the comma is what we're asking the formula to check. The middle text between commas is the output if the check is true, and the final section is the output if the check bounces. This formula will keep all of the cells the same as the first cell, so if there's syrup in A1, there will be syrup covering the whole waffle. If you were to drag the formula upward, from let's say D4, you would receive a hash ref error. In this case, you would want to change the formula from A1 to $A$1. Or €A€1 in Europe. Now go ahead and drag up and the formula works again. Some people like to eat breakfast waffles with only about half of the cells populated with data, and others like all of the cells' fields to be filled out. Some people like to write extra long lines of data and let it spill over into the next column, or they choose the wrap text option, spilling the data lower into a thicker row. When the data starts to spill out of the table, you might have problems on either side of this analogy. Other Excel options are quite easy with waffles. Pivot tables, for example, can be accomplished several ways. First, you could rotate the plate to pivot the waffle. Second, you could stand up and sit in the adjacent seat perpendicular to the waffles. Or third, you could literally pivot the kitchen table 90 degrees, which is where the pivot table tool gets its name. Now, finally, sink your teeth into the data. Additionally, both waffles and Excel spreadsheets can be shared and enjoyed by multiple people. With waffles, this would involve making a batch of waffles and sharing them with friends or family. With Excel spreadsheets, this would involve sharing the spreadsheet with others and collaborating on the data within it. Special note. For many of the remaining recipes, the use of toaster bags will be utilized. Please do not attempt these recipes without toaster bags, as it may result in toaster bag manufacturers not reaching forecasted quarterly profits. Recipe number 12, leftover pizza slices. In math, pizza is represented by the symbol pizza and is used to feed everyone from teenagers, mutants, ninjas, to turtles. Now in cooking, pie is represented by the symbol pie, and is used to represent the ratio of a dish's circumference to its diameter. This ratio is always the same, regardless of the size of the dish, and is approximately equal to 3.14159265359793238. What do these two things have in common? Well, they both start with the letters P and I. This means that if you were to start writing either word on paper, nobody would know which of the two words you were writing until you either stopped or continued. That being said, if you were to write the word pizza increasingly slowly, the reader would never be able to discern if you were done or not, and as such, it would be impossible to know which word you were actually writing. This might be an excellent way to get out of a very specific written argument, actually, as long as the two final options were only pie or pizza. This would not apply to the word piz, a Russian river or wavelet compression method, nor the word piz, which is an abbreviation for the pizzicato playing style when written on orchestral sheet music. Please only use this information for self-defense. If you'll remember back to the previous waffles with syrup recipe, we introduced the geometry of our food. Well, in this chapter, we need to understand pie to fully appreciate this dish. We could probably also get into the non-Euclidean geometry aspects since pizza has a curved or non-linear shape, but since the pizza is not being made from scratch, we can conveniently skip that step. However, we do need to understand how to find the area of a slice of pizza before we can reheat it in the toaster. To do this, you simply calculate the area of the entire pizza, which is pi r squared. We know there is always 360 degrees in a circle, so if the angle of the slice is 45 degrees, we know it's 1/8 of the whole pizza. Now just multiply the whole pizza by 1/8 or 0.125, and you will have the area of a single slice. Don't forget that during the setup chapter of this cookbook, we should have taken the extra time to count our toaster's slots and verified that there were, in fact, two slots. This means we need to multiply the result of our equation above by 2. Now, if your original pizza was a disgusting square-cut pizza, you can simply refer to Chapter 11 for the geometry required to reheat it. Yuck! Congratulations! You may now insert your pizza slices into the corresponding sized toaster bags and insert them into the toaster. The toaster setting you choose is a personal preference, so please make a selection and push the toaster's lever down to begin the reheating process. Once the toaster has completed the reheating process, the automated pop-up feature will raise the slices out of the slots, and depending on how strong the spring is, may even plate the dish for you. Be certain to remove the toaster bags from the pizza slices, and then consume the pizza, not the toaster bags. Recipe number 13, grilled cheese. Hopefully you bought enough toaster bags for more than one dish because we're not done with them yet. If you've used your only two toaster bags on the last recipe, you'll need to either retrieve them from the garbage and wipe them off or go out to the grocery store at this crazy hour to buy some new ones. Don't make this mistake again either. The next chapter is using them too, so get a big, even number of them and learn from your mistakes. Gather your simple ingredients. 2 bread slices, 2 cheese slices, and 2 butter slices. Place the cheese slices onto the buttered bread slices. Can you handle those 2 steps at once? You're certainly a pro by now. Turn your toaster on its side and slide the bread, cheese side up, into the bags, then into the 2 slots of your tipped over toaster. This allows the cheese to melt into the bread slices. If you were too lazy to get more toaster bags, this method will still work, but will also damage the toaster and or start a fire, so you may only be able to make 1 grilled cheese sandwich per toaster. Fair warning, even with toaster bags, this will probably start a fire. Now, a kitchen fire at first might be a good thing because it will help melt the cheese faster, but after a brief moment, the kitchen fire is no longer useful and could pose a serious risk to the final dish or your health. This does raise an interesting point, though, that cooking with unconventional techniques such as house fires, napalm, flamethrowers, or even bombs could all technically fall under the toaster descriptor. Of course, the inconvenience of how far away the grilled cheese itself would have to be from the heat source is unrealistic, especially in the case of a nuclear bomb toaster. You could move the sandwich closer, but then you'd have to remove it from the heat in a split second, or else another split second later it's burnt to a crisp. Without trial and error, it would be hard to know the duration ahead of time because the heat capacity of a grilled cheese sandwich has so many variables, such as size, shape, and temperature, as well as how much of each ingredient was used, each of which having its own heat capacity. Somehow you'll have to get the finished grilled cheese halves out of the ruined toaster. Maybe some tongs would do the trick. If your house burned down, the fire department might have to get the grilled cheese out for you. Place the two bread halves on top of one another, cheese sides together like adhesive. This step is not able to be undone, so if you have questions, now is the time to ask them. Plate the finished dish and serve fresh before the cheese unmelts. Then think about calling your parents to say hi. They haven't heard from you in a little while, and it would probably make them really happy to not have to call you first for a change. If your house just burned down, you'll eventually have to ask them for a place to crash, but don't lead with that or it'll spoil the whole phone call. Call them back the next day, and they'll be primed to help you out after having such a pleasant conversation the last time. If you sadly don't have parents anymore, please feel free to call any of the on-call parents whose numbers are vaguely hidden in Appendix A. Use any string of numbers in this appendix section, and one of our volunteer parents will pick up and be assigned to you. Enjoy your grilled cheese. Recipe number 14. Warm paninis. Warm paninis, if pronounced correctly, are just fancy grilled cheese sandwiches, so you could just put on some dress-up clothes and use the grilled cheese recipe to make this dish. You should also start with some fancier bread, though, so go get some honey challah or babka and make yourself this fancy dish the fancy way. By the way, if you are pronouncing this dish wrong, it might give your meal a bad connotation, so be careful, especially if your name ends in an S sound. James's paninis might not sound as tasty if you don't know how to correctly pronounce that third vowel sound in the critical word, and most people will be put off by what could be considered an adult film actor's stage name. Don't let that deter you, though. Just study up on linguistics of the United States. You're specifically looking to differentiate between panini and paninis, which are worlds apart to the listener. Now, if it's the actual spelling that's throwing you off, there's an easy trick. Just listen to the Simpsons animator, Eric Stefani's sister's song, Hollaback Girl, which had original lyrics that were, "This shit is paninis, P-A-N-I-N-I-S. Play this on repeat for a 40-hour work week, and you'll never spell this recipe wrong again. Now, to properly dress fancier for this dish, you'll want to custom tailor a fancy suit. You will need to follow these several specific steps. First, you will need to take your precise measurements. This is typically done using a tape measure and following a specific set of measurement guidelines. Once the measurements have been taken, they can be used to create a pattern for the suit. This pattern will then have to be used to cut the fabric for your suit and ensure that it's the correct size. After you've cut the fabric, it can be sewn together using a sewing machine or by hand. These skills may need to be rehearsed beforehand to ensure accurate fanciness levels. One sewing mistake may detract from the finished dish. This intricate process will involve attaching the various pieces of the suit, such as the jacket and pants, using a series of stitches and double stitches. Once the suit has been assembled, it can be fitted to you, the wearer. This may also involve making adjustments to the fit of the suit, such as taking in the waist or adding darts to the jacket. Finally, the suit can be finished with details such as buttons, lining, and other embellishments. A top hat and monocle may be added to your overall fancy attire to complete this recipe. Enjoy my warm paninis, you fancy grande horizontal. Recipe number 15. The secret recipe. Tony, don't put this one in the cookbook. It's just for us. The secret recipe, and in life, is to start, which will get you into the best possible relationship with them. This is super helpful because they give you the authority to do whatever you want with all of that money, tax-free, by the way. You don't even need to do anything complicated like you may have thought prior to this chapter. Just follow the few simple instructions on the previous pages and then contact that phone number so you'll be totally set for life. See, it really is all about who you know, and it was my pleasure to be able to introduce you to them. No need to thank me. Congratulations. Recipe number 16. The recipe for success. Sometimes you just need to set the bar a little lower and succeed, succeed, succeed. This might be a little off-key coming from a comedy cookbook, but have you thought about this yet? That this might actually be a motivational book draped in the cloak of a cookbook using the toaster as a metaphor. If you thought these recipes were overcomplicated, then you're ahead of the game, but there's definitely more to it than just that. Well, here we are, the most important recipe in this cookbook, the recipe for success. This is where the cookbook might get a little cocky and up its own ass, like James Paninis. Accomplishing small, digestible goals can have a big impact on our mental health and overall success. When we set and achieve goals, no matter how small they may seem, we experience a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction that can boost our confidence and motivation. This, in turn, can improve our mental health and pave the way for greater success in the future. One of the key benefits of setting and achieving small goals is that they provide us with a sense of progress and forward momentum. When we're working towards a big goal, it can often feel overwhelming and daunting. But by breaking that goal down into smaller, manageable tasks, we can feel a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction as we check each one off our list. This can give us the motivation and confidence we need to continue pushing forward, and it can help us stay focused and on track. Another advantage of setting and achieving small goals is that they can help us build good habits and improve our overall productivity. When we set a goal, we're essentially creating a plan for how we want to spend our time and energy. By setting small goals, we can create a series of simple, achievable tasks that we can complete each day, which can help us develop good habits and become more efficient and productive. Over time, these habits can add up to significant improvements in our overall well-being and success. Furthermore, setting and achieving small goals can help us build resilience and adaptability. When we set a goal, we're inevitably going to encounter obstacles and setbacks along the way. But by setting small goals, we can learn to overcome these challenges and bounce back from failure. This can help us develop the resilience and adaptability we need to succeed in the long run. Much like a cookbook does, you can break things down into their component parts and tackle them one small set at a time. On the other hand, overcomplicating things is a common problem that many people tend to face. Hopefully, the cookbook you've read up to this point has illuminated some examples. It can lead to unnecessary stress, confusion, and wasted time and effort. However, there are several simple strategies that you can use to avoid overcomplicating things in your life. First, it's important to take a step back and assess the whole situation. Ask yourself if the task at hand really requires as much complexity as you are putting into it. Often we can get caught up in the details and lose sight of the big picture, causing us to overcomplicate things unnecessarily. By taking a moment to pause and reflect, you can avoid this trap and simplify your approach. Another key strategy is to focus on the basics. Rather than trying to tackle a complex problem all at once, break it down into smaller, more manageable pieces. Again, think cookbook steps. Focus on the core elements of the task and work on those first, adding in additional details and complexity only if necessary. This will help you to avoid getting bogged down in unnecessary details and stay focused on what really matters. It's also important to be organized and disciplined in your approach. This means setting clear goals and priorities and then sticking to them. By staying focused and avoiding distractions, you can avoid getting sidetracked and overcomplicating things. Additionally, try to avoid multitasking, as this can lead to a fragmented and disorganized approach that can make things more complicated. Instead, focus on one task at a time and give it your full attention. Finally, remember to keep things in perspective. Sometimes we can get caught up in the details and lose sight of the overall goal. This can cause us to overcomplicate things and make them more difficult than they need to be. By maintaining a healthy perspective and staying focused on the end goal, you can stay on task and keep things simple. It's very easy to fall into the gravitational pull of overcomplicating things. We often think that by making something more complex that we're making it better. However, this is certainly not always the case. In fact, overcomplication can often lead to more problems and less efficiency. One of the major problems with overcomplicating things is that it can make them more difficult to understand. This is particularly true when it comes to things like technology or computers. If something is too complex, it can be hard for people to use it effectively. This can lead to frustration and ultimately a lack of adoption. Another issue with overcomplication is that it can make it harder to identify and fix problems. When something is simple, it is easier to troubleshoot, especially when broken down into smaller parts. With a complex system, it can be difficult to know where to even begin. This can lead to wasted time and resources as people struggle to find the root of the problem. Overcomplication can easily lead to a lack of motivation and create unnecessary roadblocks while trying to reach your goals. It may even prevent you from starting your journey entirely. Motivation is an essential component of good mental health. It gives us the drive and determination to set and achieve our goals, and it helps us to stay focused and engaged in our lives. Unfortunately, many people struggle with motivation, and this can sadly have a negative impact on their mental health. Coincidentally, one way to improve motivation and mental health is to, again, avoid overcomplicating things. When we set goals that are too complex or ambitious, we can quickly become overwhelmed and lose sight of our progress. This can lead to feelings of frustration and failure, which can in turn erode our motivation and mental health. Instead, it is better to set small, achievable goals that we can realistically accomplish. Succeed, succeed, succeed. This will give us a sense of accomplishment and progress, which can help to boost our motivation and mental health. For example, instead of trying to lose 20 pounds in a month, we could set a goal to eat healthier and exercise for 30 minutes a day. This smaller, concrete, and more manageable goal will be easier to achieve, which will give us a sense of accomplishment and progress that will keep us motivated. It's also vitally important to celebrate our successes and progress, no matter how small they may seem. This can help to reinforce our motivation and keep us moving forward. Our human brains crave routines, get in the habit of succeeding while also celebrating those successes with a small, healthy reward system. You can do the same thing for major successes as well. For example, if we reach our goal of exercising for 30 minutes a day over a certain period of time, we could celebrate by treating ourselves to a new workout outfit or going out for a nice, healthy meal. This positive reinforcement will help to keep us motivated and on track. We should also try our best to surround ourselves with supportive and positive people who can help us to stay motivated and focused on our goals. These people can provide encouragement, advice, and accountability, which can all be essential for maintaining motivation and good mental health. For example, we could join a support group or exercise class, or simply spend time with friends and family who support our goals and help us to stay motivated. A toaster can be a useful analogy for bettering oneself. Or buttering oneself. Sorry, the temptation was too strong. Just like a toaster turns plain bread into something delicious, a person can take their ordinary talents and abilities and transform them into something truly remarkable. Think about it. A toaster doesn't just toast bread on its own. It requires the right ingredients, like bread and electricity, as well as the right settings, like temperature and time. Similarly, a person needs the right tools and resources, like education and experience, as well as the right mindset, like determination and hard work, to improve themselves. Just like a toaster produces the best results when it's well-maintained and used properly, a person will achieve the most success when they take care of themselves and use their abilities wisely. And also, just like a toaster can produce a range of results, from lightly toasted to burnt, a person's growth and improvement can also vary, depending on their effort and dedication. Recipe number 17, classic, 1643, duck pâté en croûte. If you've made it this far, you should feel very accomplished, even if you weren't actually cooking all those previous dishes. It's pretty obvious you weren't, and that's okay, but it isn't too late to start either. Just trying to save you a little time with that double contraction, you're welcome. Join in for one final dish, one grand finale of toaster appreciation. Buckle up. You're going to need all the training you developed for this extra special course. Duck pâté en croûte is a dish that typically consists of a mixture of ground duck meat and seasonings, which is then encased in a flaky pastry crust and baked until golden brown. The ingredients include duck meat, butter, onions, garlic, cognac or brandy, salt, pepper, and herbs, such as thyme and parsley. The pastry crust is made from butter, flour, salt, and water, and may also include an egg wash to give it a golden color. Other ingredients, such as bacon or liver, may also be added to the filling for added flavor. 1 duck meat, ground, 1 onion, chopped, 1 clove garlic, minced, 1 egg, beaten, 1 tablespoon butter, 1 tablespoon cognac or brandy, 1 tablespoon heavy cream, 1 teaspoon thyme or parsley, chopped, 1 half teaspoon salt, 1 quarter teaspoon ground black pepper. 1 sheet of thawed puff pastry, 1 cup breadcrumbs. In the 17th century, the cooking methods and techniques available were somewhat limited compared to those of today. So the authentic 1643 recipe is prepared as follows. First, prepare the duck pâté filling. This will involve grinding the duck meat and mixing it with herbs and spices, as well as other ingredients such as breadcrumbs or eggs to bind it together. To do this, use a large skillet and melt the butter over medium heat. Add the onion and garlic and cook until softened, about 5 minutes. Add the ground duck meat into the skillet and cook until browned on both sides, about 5 minutes. Add the cognac or brandy, cream, thyme or parsley, salt and pepper to the skillet and stir to combine. Bring the mixture to a simmer and cook for an additional 5 minutes. Transfer the duck meat mixture to a small pie dish. The pâté is then placed inside the pastry crust, which is made by combining flour, butter, and water to form a dough. To do this, roll out the puff pastry on a lightly floured surface to a size that is slightly larger than the pie dish. Cut a small hole in the center of the pastry to allow steam to escape. The dough is then rolled out and shaped to fit the pâté. Carefully place the pastry over the duck meat mixture, pressing the edges to seal them. Brush the pastry with the beaten egg. Verify the sealed edges of the pastry crust and then decorate with designs or patterns. Place the pie dish on a baking sheet and bake in the preheated oven for about a half hour, or until the pastry is golden brown and puffed. The 1643 method would use a wood-fired oven. If you'd like to stay true to the original recipe, you should consider their lack of technology. This was the most common method of cooking in the 17th century, and it would have required careful attention to control the heat and ensure that the pâté was cooked evenly. Let the duck pâté en croûte cool for a few minutes before serving whole or slicing into portions. Serve with toast points. To make toast points using a toaster, the most important part of this recipe, first slice a loaf of bread into thin diagonal slices. Place the slices in the toaster and toast them until they are golden brown and crispy. Once the toast points are ready, remove them from the toaster and let them cool for a few minutes before serving. You can serve the toast points plain or topped with butter, cheese, or other toppings of your choice. To ensure that your toast points turn out perfectly, be sure to use a sharp knife to slice the bread evenly and avoid over-toasting the bread. It can also be helpful to upgrade to a higher quality toaster with adjustable heat settings for this dish, so that you can adjust the heat to suit the specific needs of the bread you're using and your personal preference for the level of toastiness. This final dish should also be accompanied by a variety of other dishes, such as roasted vegetables or other meats, as well as wines or other beverages too. Place the finished dishes under a cloche, say the magic word please, and reveal by lifting the cloche and saying voila. Upon completion of this last dish, you have now earned 192 toast points and have completed this cookbook. Congratulations! Appendix B. Build your own pop-up toaster. To build your own pop-up toaster, you will need some basic materials and tools, as well as a general understanding of electrical circuits and wiring. The following are the steps you can take to build a pop-up toaster. Gather the materials you will need, including a metal toaster housing, a coiled heating element, bread holders, wire, and a power supply. Cut 2 slots in the metal toaster housing for the bread slices to fit into. These should be spaced far enough apart to accommodate the thickness of the bread. Attach the bread holders to the inside of the toaster housing, making sure they are aligned with the slots you cut in the previous step. Install the coiled heating element inside the metal toaster housing, making sure it's positioned near the bread holders. Use screws to secure the heating element coils in place. Connect the heating element coils to the power source using the wire and power supply. Make sure all connections are secure and there are no loose wires that could cause a short circuit. Test the toaster by placing a piece of bread into each of the slots and turning on the power. The bread should toast evenly, and the heating elements should get hot enough to turn the bread into toast. If everything is working correctly, you can add additional features to your toaster, such as a timer, a temperature control, or perhaps most importantly, a pop-up mechanism to automatically lift the toast out of the toaster when it is done. Remember to use caution when working with electricity, and make sure to follow all safety guidelines. If you are unsure about any step in the process, it is best to consult with a professional or seek guidance from an experienced toast expert. Appendix C. How to Write a Cookbook. To write a cookbook, you would need to start by deciding on a theme or cuisine that the cookbook will focus on. This will help to give the cookbook a sense of cohesiveness and direction. Once you have a theme in mind, you can begin to compile a list of recipes to include in the cookbook. As you develop your recipes, be sure to include detailed instructions for each step of the cooking process, as well as any helpful tips or variations on the recipe. You will also need to include information about the ingredients needed for each recipe, measurements, and any special instructions for preparing the ingredients. In addition to the recipes, you may want to include an introduction or other informational sections in your cookbook. This could include details about the theme of the cookbook, the history and origins of the cuisine, and any interesting facts or anecdotes related to the recipes. Once you have all of the recipes and other content compiled, you can begin to organize and format the cookbook. This includes designing a cover, dividing the book into chapters or sections, and arranging the recipes in a logical order. You may also want to include photographs or illustrations to enhance the cookbook and make it more visually appealing. After the cookbook is complete, you will need to proofread and edit it to ensure that all of the content is accurate and free of errors. Once you are satisfied with the final product, you can publish your cookbook, either by self-publishing or by seeking a traditional publishing deal. Appendix D, How to Write a Toaster Cookbook. If you want to write a cookbook that only uses a toaster and not a toaster oven, you will need to come up with a variety of recipes that can be prepared using only a standard toaster. Some dishes may include toast, buttered toast with jelly, toast with cinnamon sugar, toasted English muffins, toasted bagels, and perhaps a motivational section about how not to overcomplicate things and accomplish small goals using the toaster and the cookbook as a metaphor for life's challenges. You will have to hope that the reader makes it through the book up to that point to ensure that the metaphor lands. You'll also have to sell the cookbook as just an ordinary cookbook without targeting people who seek to be motivated, or else the metaphor and twist is spoiled. You'll be hoping that the Venn diagram of toaster cookbook lovers overlaps the people seeking motivation quite a lot. Maybe you could put a big asterisk on the cover so that it catches the reader's eye and fascinates them, or entices them to pick it up and read it. The cookbook could use comedy to keep the reader engaged enough to push through to the motivational section hiding toward the back, but you'll have to be careful not to make the chapters too long, or else it might get stale. However, you'll want them to be long enough so the reader doesn't become disengaged and feel that you're phoning it in. Pictures may help, so you might consider paying a little more upfront to print the interior of the book in color to maintain the reader's interest longer. When the reader does finally get to the motivational section of the book, you will have to find a way to write it without sounding super pretentious, a feat that may not actually be possible, but worth a shot. Maybe draw attention to the idea that it's a little tongue-in-cheek by creating an adult film actor stage name and using it to say that chapter might get up its own ass a little. Then debate for a week about if that's too crude to put into a semi-serious chapter of a comedy cookbook. Ultimately, the joke will stay because it's the comedy of the book that kept the reader going, and getting through a much drier motivational chapter could use a bit of comedic relief since that's the climax of the book. And to lose a reader there would render the entire book pointless. Once the book is written, you'll have to decide on a cover image and a write-up for the rear of the book. This text description will probably be the only thing that will clue potential readers into picking up the book. Remember, the cover looks like a normal cookbook, with the exception of that big-ass asterisk, an asterisk, that's doing a lot of heavy lifting. Choose the back text carefully because you won't want to give too much away all at once. But you also don't want the cookbook to sound too silly to read either. There's a fine line here, and you'll have to try to thread the needle to make it enticing. Think about the steps a potential reader will have to make in order to reach the intended goal of getting all the way to the motivational section of the cookbook. First, they see the bright cover. Then they're intrigued by the asterisk. They turn the book over, or click to see the rear online, and read the brief but captivatingly funny write-up. They may flip through some pages if they can, but from here they'd have to decide to purchase the book. Next, they would need to read it and enjoy the comedy and pictures enough to get all the way to page 143, which is actually just page 137 because you tricked them. Then, and only then, do they find out the twist that the book is a metaphor, and the goal was to help give them an understanding of how to declutter their lives a little. At this point, they've achieved the intended goal, but you should also hope that they enjoy the twist enough to spread the word by mouth to their friends or family. If they get all the way through Appendix D, you may even tell them to do that directly, share it with their friends and family, and they should do that right now, perhaps. Go ahead, send a text message right now. In addition to these recipes, you could also include a variety of other dishes that can be prepared using a toaster in a creative way, or as an accessory to the main course, maybe as a big grand finale dish. With a little creativity and experimentation, you can come up with a wide range of delicious recipes that can be made using only a toaster. If you're clever enough, you may even be able to write about dishes that are unique to your cookbook alone that nobody else would be crazy enough to think up. Appendix E, about the author. Patrick R.F. Blakely grew up as a young toaster in North Syracuse, New York, USA, Earth, Orion Arm, Milky Way, Local Group, Virgo Supercluster, Laniakea Supercluster, Universe Hash 291, 419,303. If humanity goes extinct and future evolved inhabitants find only this book to understand the human race, well, good luck, bon chance, viel gluck, buena suerte, likatil, e sanslar, hz siid, mwfq bashid, kaihoch kadi, chuck mayman, kyle tuke, chastlivo, juni hao yun, xing yun wo, and hengunul bibnida. Patrick's obsession with toasters began inconspicuously when choosing a username for an online chat program called America Online Instant Messenger, AOL Instant Messenger, or just AIM. Anyway, his original usernames included PappyDude2, chosen by his father, Smudge223, a spelling word in middle school, and ToxicToast212, after a favorite Mighty Mighty Bosstones song, and the original band name of the lead singer Dickie Barrett. In college, he decided he needed to find a username that started with the letter A, since the friend list on everyone's program was sorted alphabetically. Another stipulation was that he wanted a clean username that didn't have any superfluous numbers attached to the end. He found himself repeatedly clicking on the Wikipedia random page button until he found something interesting, a page about toasters. This page struck him because his current username also had the word toast in it, and the first image on the page had a caption, "Two slot toaster." This was all the inspiration he needed. By simply adding the letter A to the front of the caption, he had himself a unique username that would be at the top of the username list, and it didn't need any additional numbers at the end. We did it, everyone! From here, Patrick thought about making the nickname Toast Stick, but the idea was too cringy, though the nickname was really, really good. However, going further, he started using the username everywhere online. One message board, the Something Awful Forums, or simply SA, Hello Fellow Goons, I'm Protected, etc., required an avatar to use with the online profile. This wasn't a problem because the SA Mart threads always had artists willing to help. One artist gifted an avatar of a cartoon toaster with a big number 2 on top and a funny grimace. It was clever and perfect. After a while, Patrick looked into some toaster history and decided to purchase a restored 1934 antique toaster, the first ever automatic pop-up two-slot toaster. Using a master restorer from New York City Toaster Central, Patrick acquired the very first item in his toaster collection. The collection has since grown to include anything related to toast, from books about toasts, wedding toasts for example, books by fake people named Toast, pictures of people almost named Toast, toast ale, bread and butter wine, toast street signs, toast town pamphlets, paint colors with toast in the name, CDs by bands like The Toasters, autographed promo posters by bands like The Toasters, ticket stubs for shows for bands like The Toasters, stuffed animals like Beanie Babies whose names are Toast, computer hardware and discs for video toaster software made by Dana Carvey's brother, toast shirts, neckties, and so much more. Patrick is also a member of the Toaster Collectors Association. Yes, that's real. Look it up. The association meets officially once per year somewhere in the U.S. and talks about the unique and niche hobby. Patrick is a marching band music judge and has written several other books, mostly about percussion and marching music, but some historical essays as well. If you're interested in tenor drumming or Tare Hill, You might be the most similar person to Patrick in the whole world, and that's saying something because Patrick is a twin. If you enjoyed this cookbook and found it entertaining, please consider sharing it with a friend. Independent books rely heavily on word-of-mouth promotion, and passing along this title is a big help. It would mean a lot if you searched for Patrick R.F. Blakely and rated this book on Amazon.com and Goodreads.com. If you enjoyed this cookbook but don't enjoy cooking, you can get toast delivered to your door instead at a2slottoaster.com. The best bread is 14 millimeters thick. The ideal cooking time is precisely 216 seconds. The ideal amount of butter is 0.44 grams per square inch. Dr. Dom Lane, consultant food researcher.